We do want to urge everybody in Los Angeles to know whether or not they've had measles vaccine or have immunity to measles. There are certain people for whom it's very important that they have two doses of vaccine. While one dose of vaccine is good and is generally recommended for adults, two doses is better.
Dr. Sharon Balter at LA County's Public Health Department, she and other health officials ordered more than 200 UCLA and Cal State LA students and staff to be quarantined to prevent the spread of measles. Meanwhile, in Sacramento, a hearing this week on a measles bill drew lots of protesters. Hundreds of people lined up to comment against a bill that would strengthen vaccine requirements.
Dr. Tiffany Baer, Berkeley, California, strongly oppose.
My name is Aspen Carney and I oppose this bill.
My name is Vicki Carney. I'm in Senator Morlock's district. I'm a parent and I oppose this bill.
Okay, let's talk to Sacramento Bee reporter Hannah Wiley about this story. Hi, Hannah. Well, we're still trying to get Hannah on the line. Also joining us to talk about how measles is spreading, we're joined by Dr. Johann Bester. He's a bioethics director at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas School of Medicine. Welcome to you.
Hi, thank you.
Okay, well, why are college campuses more vulnerable to the spread of diseases like measles?
So infectious diseases depend on people being in contact with one another. So if you have lots of people congregating in a close space where they have contact with one another, that's always a risk factor for the spread of infectious disease. But in college campuses, schools, places like that, people tend to spend a lot of time there and a lot of time with each other and be in contact with a whole host of people from all over. And so that is a good breeding ground for an infectious disease.
Yeah, makes sense.
Now, I will say that most schools and campuses have requirements for vaccination in place before you join the school or become a student at the school because of this.
Is there any problem with the fact that this generation of students came of age, if you will, as they were young at the time when this anti-vax push, the latest anti-vax push, the scare over the MMR, really took off? Are there more unvaccinated college students now than there were?
So California has an interesting history with vaccine refusal. It was one of the places where we had significant push from some parents and concerned people to refuse vaccinations because of objections to the vaccine. And then in 2015, there was that big measles outbreak that started with a case of exposure at Disneyland that caused measles outbreaks all over the country because these tend to connect and spread through chains of susceptibility. And after that, the law in California changed and tightened up quite a bit. And now, to attend school, a public school, you can only have medical exemptions from vaccination or you have to prove that you've been vaccinated. But that's only recently. So there might be a whole generation of children that have now grown up that might be under-vaccinated. Now, again, the vaccine uptake rate was still pretty good in California. It was just not the 90-95% threshold that we would like. That has improved since the law has changed.
Okay, well, speaking of that law, there's now a new bill that would actually strengthen that law because it turns out that some doctors are writing medical exemptions when maybe they aren't necessary, medically necessary. Hannah, you're back now with us at the Sacramento Bee. Can you explain what this bill would do, this Senate Bill 276?
Sure. So Senate Bill 276 addresses what lawmakers kind of consider a loophole from the 2015 legislation that really strengthened California's vaccination laws. So Senate Bill 276 requires doctors to fill out a form that the state is actually going to create. The State Department of Public Health will create a standard form that doctors have to fill out to qualify a child for a medical exemption. And then the doctor would file that form back to the state public health department to approve or deny the exemption. And then if it's denied, the doctor does have the opportunity to appeal that decision, but really creating an oversight of these exemptions that Senator Pan, who's authoring the legislation, considers fake or fraudulent.
And how would lawmakers in Sacramento or the agency assigned to review these medical exemptions, how would they know whether or not they're valid?
Right. So the public health officials are going to use qualifications under the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the list of qualified medical exemptions. And really, those are reserved for very limited cases. They're reserved for, I think, children with autoimmune disorders or individuals with life-threatening allergic reactions to vaccines, or even kids with cancer and undergoing chemotherapy. I mean, it's really reserved for a small percentage of children who would be put at extreme risk if they were exposed to some of these preventable communicable diseases.
Well, I know that some doctors think a family history of autoimmune disease is enough reason for medical exemption. And so is that something that Dr. Bester is something that most doctors look at as a possible reason for medical exemption, or is that something that most doctors dismiss as not a quality to do that, not qualified for
well,
that?
They shouldn't look at that in isolation. As we've heard, there are limited medical conditions that would make it more of a risk for you to get the vaccine than for other people. And it's been well covered. It's allergy, and if you yourself have an immune disorder. So family history itself is not enough.
Although I know there is a doctor in San Diego who's written a lot of medical exemptions who says, yes, it is. She thinks it is enough.
That is not correct. So it is true that if you have a family history of certain autoimmune disorders or certain immune deficiency disorders, you are at higher risk of having the immune deficiency disorder. But that in itself does not mean that you have the immune deficiency disorder. The reason why it's a problem to give this vaccine to children who have an immune deficiency is that this is a augmented virus or a live virus vaccine that doesn't make you sick if you have a normal immune system, but makes you immune against measles as you fight it off. But people who have a compromised immune system cannot necessarily fight the virus off, and they become sick from this virus. So the problem is your immune system is compromised, not necessarily family history on its own.
Right. Okay. So, Hannah, I understand there was a lot of opposition, and a lot of people there testifying or speaking in favor of the bill as well. Can you just describe the tenor of the discussion when this bill was being debated?
Absolutely. It was an incredibly tense hearing. I believe thousands, last number I heard was around 2,000 individuals lined up around the Capitol to share their opposition. And there was a fair amount of support for the bill as well, notably from the medical community. But thousands of family members and alternative healthcare providers lined up to share that they believe this bill is overreaching, draconian, that Senator Pan is going back on his word from years past when he authored Senate Bill 277. And I mean, it's just such a heated topic and such a concern for parents. It was hot in the hallways. It was crowded. It was noisy. Names were being thrown around. It just was a very lengthy process, but the bill did make it out of committee.
Okay. And just to note that Senator Richard Pan, who's a Democrat from Sacramento, is a pediatrician. So he has some expertise
Absolutely.
In this. And so, Dr. Bester, when you hear this and this level of opposition, what do you make of it?
I'm not surprised. The people who are skeptical of vaccines or oppose vaccines are generally convinced that it is a liberty right that is infringed on if you mandate vaccination. So it's a deeply emotive issue. It forms part of some people's identity. They have a peer group of people who share their views that vaccines are dangerous, and they, some of them are deeply distrustful of government and of healthcare systems to begin with. And so I could see that people would feel this is government overreach. But I think what gets lost in the conversation is that the focus is on protecting children against dangerous diseases. And so we actually have a shared goal with these parents, government, medical communities, doctors, parents. They share the goal of wanting to do what is best for the child.
Okay. And so when it comes to trying to curb the spread of measles right now, what do you think is the best way to do that? And are you concerned that this could become more widespread?
Yes. So for some time now, we've been vaccinating at rates that are substandard, in my view, in the United States. And high levels of vaccination is the best and really only way to make sure that measles stays away. Measles was declared eliminated from the U.S. in 2000, and that was because of a sustained vaccination effort. But it can come back if our vaccine rates drop. And so some of these outbreaks that we see now are sort of harbingers that we should pay attention to our vaccination rates. Now, with measles in particular, to keep it at bay and to keep it out, we have to vaccinate at rates of around 95% uptake with two doses of measles vaccine. So that is the one thing. And the other thing is what we're seeing now happening at some of the universities. When outbreaks happen, we need public health intervention to stop outbreaks in its tracks.
So you think what they're doing here at UCLA and Cal State LA, that's the right thing to do, quarantine?
Well, if you're unsure of people's immune status and there's a risk that they were exposed to measles and they could spread it to others, then quarantine is one of the tools that can be used to limit the outbreak. But the best tool still is vaccination.
Dr. Johann Bester, he's the bioethics director at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas School of Medicine. Hannah Wiley, legislative reporter for the Sacramento Bee. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, another proposed law in California would ban Teach for America entirely in the whole state. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. California lawmakers are targeting Teach for America, the group that places young college graduates in struggling classrooms. Here's an ad from Teach for America describing their mission.
But at Teach for America, we've seen too much progress to believe that your education has to be determined by where you live. And it's our mission to help our nation deliver on its promise so that every child has access to the same opportunities and choices.
Okay, that sounds good, but there have been problems at Teach for America, or at least problems in classrooms who take Teach for America teachers. The problem being many of those teachers aren't really taught a lot about how to teach in challenging circumstances, or they'll leave just after a couple of years, which really upends the classroom. Earlier this year, a bill was introduced in Sacramento that would ban schools from hiring teachers from outside groups, especially those that have short-term contracts. Mackenzie Mays covers education in California for Politico. Hi.
Hi.
Well, let's get a little backgrounder on Teach for America. It's been around for a long time now, and it was initially seen as a win-win, really a solution for schools that needed to attract more teachers, and then a way for young, idealistic college students or recent graduates to do good. So where did it fall short?
Yeah, so it's considered a pretty prestigious program. I think the acceptance rate is 15%, and you get Ivy Leaguers who want to do good in high-need communities. And so they sign up to teach for 2 years in some of the neediest school districts in the country. But the problem that teachers unions have always had with these programs is that they say that these people aren't trained in the traditional way, and they aren't. So they go through about 5 weeks of training over the summer. And so they say it's sort of a Band-Aid to a problem that is a big deal, like teacher shortages and turnover rates. And so the person introducing this bill, Assemblywoman Christina Garcia, was a teacher. And she just says that it's unfair that we put what she considers the least trained educators in some of the districts that need it the most. I think one of her quotes was that we wouldn't put these teachers in the Beverly Hillses of the state.
Okay, and so she wants a total ban on these teachers?
Yeah, it's interesting. So the bill started out, the text actually said that no Teach for America in the state, which as far as we know is the first legislative attempt like this in the country. And then some amendments have passed that don't name Teach for America, but it would block cornerstones of the program. So like no third party can be hired to hire teachers for less than 5 years, which obviously guts the 2 year part of TFA. It still essentially does the same thing without naming TFA.
What's the response from TFA?
So I talked to some alumni. I mean, they say they only mean well. And I talked to people who had no intentions of going into education, right? So people who graduated with business degrees, who ended up teaching in needy schools in Atlanta, who now are teachers for life. And so they say they wouldn't have done that had it not been for Teach for America. But at the same time, opponents say that most of them, you know, some of the worst criticisms, I guess, the strongest criticisms are that they use it as a resume builder for themselves instead of to stick around and help the kids.
And what do people who are in these schools who have to take these teachers or do take these teachers, like, what do they say about them in general?
Well, I mean, right now in California, we're dealing with a lot of teacher momentum, right? Sacramento teachers went on strike, and that follows LA and Oakland. And it's coming at a time when teachers are demanding more stable funding for schools. And they say that TFA and programs like it aren't helping that instead of hiring outside and looking elsewhere to put resources and support into the places that plan to make this their lifelong gigs, right? So they just feel like it's unfair, I guess, to the entire system.
Mm-hmm. Is this seen as kind of another proxy battle over charter schools? Because a lot of these teachers in Teach for America go to charter schools.
Yeah, so I asked that. I mean, it's charter war right now in California. And Teach for America itself said they have been aligned with charter schools, but they say that's unfair. That's an unfair correlation there, that because they're an alternative route to teacher training and to education, that doesn't mean that they prefer charters over traditional schools. But like you said, people who become interested in education policy that might go through TFA do come out with maybe some reform ideas. A third of Teach for America core members are actually in charter schools. But TFA says that's because charter schools often pop up in needy communities and that's their priority. So the assemblywoman who's authoring this bill says that the anti-charter movement right now isn't behind that she just thinks it's unfair to some of the neediest kids. But there are others who definitely think that there's an association there.
But how is Teach for America accepted in a school system that is a union-based school system? So that if you were like a district school here in Los Angeles, how are you allowed to hire a Teach for America teacher when you've got to abide by union rules in hiring and firing?
So an interesting sort of battle happened recently. You know, you might have heard about it in national news when teachers in Oakland were striking. There was a lot of backlash because TFA had written a letter that seemed to tell its members to cross picket lines and to not go on strike. And that caused a lot of, you know, they went
blowback? Anger?
Yeah. It was a moment because they felt that was unfair because these teachers are, they're paid by the districts that they're working for. And likely at the same rates. Mm-hmm. That's not really how it works. I think there's a fee maybe that the districts have to pay through TFA, but otherwise the process is all the same. It's just like getting like an intern credential or something like that. Anything that is in the short term for teachers.
So where are we with this? It passed in a small committee. And do you think it'll pass in the general legislature and be signed by the governor?
I think it's early. It's super early. But it passed easily in its first hearing. And the only person that voted against it in the Assembly Education Committee is the only Republican on the committee and is also a TFA alum.
Huh.
So I think it's too soon to know. I think it's certainly controversial. But education has really come to the forefront in California right now, and I think people really care about it. And Democrats are behind the charter movement as well, so we'll see.
Mackenzie Mays, she covers education in California for Politico. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Coming up, modern Satanists don't really think Satan is the devil.
They think of the Satan figure as being rebellious, as being kind of mischievous, as being, you know, sort of standing up against tyrannical authority and, you know, encouraging mankind to kind of think for ourselves.
Inside the modern day satanic temple, next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand, and now we are going to talk about Satanists, the Satanic Temple specifically. They don't worship the devil per se, but they do like to say Hail Satan a lot.
Hail Satan.
Hail Satan.
Hail Satan.
Hail Satan.
Well, Hail Satan is the title of a new documentary about this group, which actually has a serious mission. It is trying to fight Christian fundamentalism. Penny Lane directed Hail Satan, and she joins me now. Hi.
Hello.
Well, actually, there's a question mark at the end of the title of your documentary. So it's more like Hail Satan. So why the question mark?
Well, the question mark is there because, you know, a lot more people would be interested in this film than might know it from the declarative title, Hail Satan. And so the question mark is really there to kind of invite people who might not be quite so sure what's going on here to maybe check it out.
Maybe check out the movie and the actual organization?
Yeah, exactly.
They're called the Satanic Temple, but they don't actually worship the devil.
Yeah, we should just get that right out of the way.
So why do they call themselves the Satanic Temple if they don't worship Satan?
Yeah, so Satanism as a modern religion has been around for about, 55 years now. And the Satanic Temple is a new religious movement made up of, you know, contemporary Satanists. So they didn't invent Satanism, but they do think of Satan as a fictional embodiment of qualities they actually admire. So they think of the Satan figure as being rebellious, as being kind of mischievous, as being sort of standing up against tyrannical authority and, you know, questioning things and encouraging mankind to kind of think for ourselves. And they've formed their religious beliefs around those qualities.
They have actually a whole tenet, right? They have seven tenets of Satanism that mm-hmm. they all repeat. Do you know what they are off the top of your head?
I probably couldn't do them all by heart. But the first tenet of the Satanic Temple is one should strive to act with compassion and empathy towards all creatures in accordance with reason. And the other six are similarly noble. They emphasize things like the importance of aligning your beliefs with our best scientific understanding of the world and standing up for what's right and engaging in the struggle for justice and things like that.
Yeah, so that all sounds worthy, noble, and serious. And yet, this is a group that a lot of people don't take seriously. Or if they do take them seriously, they just see them as mischief makers and devil worshipers. Like, they're not looking at them as seriously engaging in substantive philosophical issues or moral issues.
Yeah, absolutely. Most people take one kind of glance at any headline incorporating the words the Satanic Temple and assume that what we have here is a bunch of either evildoers or, you know, jerks who are just trying to get a rise out of people. Either one of those interpretations, is incorrect, first of all. But secondly, it doesn't invite people to want to know more.
Right. And but is part of that because they have these rituals and they dress up in sometimes funny outfits with horns on their heads and stuff?
Yeah. I mean, if you look at sort of the practice of modern Satanism as a religion, from the outside, it can look kind of off-putting to people who are not part of it or even pretty silly. But I think the Satanists would say that's really true of any religious practice. If you're not part of it, it looks pretty wacky from the outside. And one of the things they want to emphasize is that they want people in the modern world to judge people based on not what they look like, but or based on some, you know, sort of prejudice or presupposition of who they must be based on their appearance. But in fact, we should judge people based on what they do. And the Satanic Temple is really committed to doing good work in the world and showing that that's what a Satanist is.
And so what kinds of good deeds do they do?
Yeah, they cause a lot of confusion and cognitive dissonance because the Satanic Temple will collect socks for the homeless or collect menstrual products for women who need them. They clean up trash on the side of the highway. They've been known to adopt their local park or highway or beach and, you know, volunteer to get out there and clean it up every weekend. They run after school clubs. Those are the kind of obvious community service activities they engage in the name of Satanism. But people mainly know them for their good work in fighting sort of theocrats who want to impose a very specific and limited view of a Christian worldview in the government to the exclusion of other minority religions. And they see that as a good work as well.
And so that's a large focus of the documentary, is their fights, various fights with groups that are trying to erect, for example, statues of the Ten Commandments on public land.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's how I came to understand who the Satanic Temple was through these very high profile actions that they've been taking for the last 6 years in different places around the United States. So what they do is they identify a place where they believe the wall between church and state has been eroded too much. And they show up and they say, okay, well, if we're going to allow, you know, Bibles to be distributed in public schools or Christian prayer in public schools or an explicitly Christian monument to be erected on public property, then that means that the public forum is open to religious expression. And since the government cannot discriminate between religions, they can't say, well, we like this religion and we don't like that religion, you know, the Satanists have to have their equal representation as well. And, you know, sort of unsurprisingly, what tends to ensue when the Satanic Temple makes that pretty solid legal argument is a lot of chaos.
Well, talk a little bit about what went down in Arkansas, because that was a particularly pitched battle between the Satanic Temple and a group of, Christian lawmakers who wanted to put a statue of the Ten Commandments up on government property. And it got national media attention.
Oh, yeah, it sure did. So the Ten Commandments monument was proposed and then later erected on the state capitol in Little Rock. And the Satanic Temple applied with using all the same procedures to have their monument erected nearby. And their monument is to a figure called Baphomet. And Baphomet is this kind of frightening figure for most people because it has a kind of very occult, sort of look to it. It's got a goat's head and a man's body and like sort of different gender
features.
Can I
just stop you there? Because
yeah.
The sculpture, you actually show them making it, a Baphomet, and the torso is taken from the torso of Iggy Pop.
Well, yeah. One of the great torsos of the 20th century. In a very punk rock reference, right? And it has angel wings, and it's also flanked by, you know, sort of two children looking up adoringly at it. So it's a monument that's designed to get a lot of attention. But for the Satanic Temple, it's a monument that stands for you know, sort of religious pluralism and true religious freedom, which are words that a lot of lawmakers use when they try to put Bibles in public schools. They'll say this is about religious freedom. But what the Satanic Temple proves is that usually what they mean is this is about one religion being instituted by the state and, you know, not allowing any other religions in, which is a pretty poor definition of religious freedom.
And is that why they embrace the term Satan? Like, they're just trying to position themselves as the opposite of Christian fundamentalism? I mean, because they could make their point using a different name, right? Or they could have named their religion something a little less provocative.
Sure. I mean, you have the, something like the Church of the Flying Spaghetti Monster, which is, you know, sort of an atheist activist group that makes pretty similar points, kind of lampooning religion and religious privilege in America. But the thing about the Satanic Temple is that these people are Satanists. They're not pretending to be Satanists. It's just that being a Satanist doesn't mean what most of us think it means. You know, so for them, they are advocating for themselves in the public forum as Satanists. And the fact that people think it's offensive that they're Satanists, they would say that's not a very good argument for pretending that we're not Satanists, right? Like, the existence of anti-Semitism doesn't mean that Jewish people should stop being Jewish. So, you know, for them, it's kind of like part of the thing that people are offended by their existence. Certainly, the kind of person who calls themselves a Satanist is either okay with people not liking them or actively kind of looks for that. And that's true. And that's part of the kind of religious identity, I guess. But at the same time, you know, if you say, well, they could make their point in a less offensive way, I mean, they would say they can't because they are Satanists.
Mm. Well, you became a Satanist, right?
No, actually, I didn't. I got a membership card to the Satanic Temple a long time ago, really kind of before we even started making the film. And then later I forgot about it and I pulled it out and realized that I was a member. And I don't think of myself as a Satanist. I think lots of people who are members of the Satanic Temple, you know, they pay $20 as essentially a way to support the organization's activist work. And that's how I think of myself. I think of myself as being very satanically aligned, let's say. I feel like I'm an ally to the movement, but I don't think of myself as a Satanist.
But why not? If you ally with it, why would you draw the line?
It's really funny because before I made this film, I definitely never imagined that I'd be in a place in my life where I had to explain all the time why I'm not a Satanist, which is very funny. It's, you know, at the end of the day, it's a religious affiliation. The images, the iconography, the rituals, they have to resonate with something within you. And it doesn't resonate for me in that way. I like the work they do in society. I support their campaigns, and their whole mission is very appealing to me, and I think it's a good mission. But as a religious identity, you know, it doesn't do anything for me to say Hail Satan. For a Satanist, saying the words Hail Satan is a very meaningful act of personal, you know, liberation. It's an announcement that they are no longer kind of held back by the superstitions of the past. But for me, it just doesn't do anything for me. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Did they win their battle in Arkansas?
Well, one of the things they like to say is that even when they lose, they win, because at the end of the day, if all they've done is sort of force a local government to show its hand and prove that it's actually not very interested in upholding the First Amendment, in a way, that's kind of a win. As of right now in Little Rock, they are suing the state of Arkansas because Arkansas threw their application out for putting up Baphomet, and they would like to see Baphomet go up. So that lawsuit is pending.
Where's Baphomet now?
Baphomet is currently at the world headquarters of the Satanic Temple in Salem, Massachusetts, and is becoming quite a popular tourist stop because you can stop and go into the art gallery there at the Satanic Temple's headquarters, and you can take your picture with Baphomet.
I wonder if Iggy Pop knows about this.
Oh, yes. I heard he does, and he's very pleased.
Of course he is.
I mean, it's pretty cool, right?
It's pretty cool. Well, Penny Lane, thank you so much. This has been really fun, really interesting.
Thank you so much for having me.
My pleasure. That's Penny Lane. She's the director of the new documentary, Hail Satan. And joining us now in In the studio is Warren Olney, host of the podcast To The Point. Hello.
Hello to you. We're going to have two podcasts out this week. The first, To The Point, is all about the Mueller report and the impeachment consequences and the struggle that's going on in the Congress. We'll talk to Adam Schiff and Brad Sherman, both Southern California congressmen, who are really quite different in terms of the timing that they would like to see.
Brad Sherman is very pro-impeachment.
Brad Sherman already has an impeachment resolution drafted and ready to go, but he's kind of buying the Pelosi argument. Nonetheless, you can hear the tension in his voice, and we get into some interesting conversation about it. We're also going to do a climate change update about air pollution, which is sort of the original component of global warming, what's being done about it, and how important it is to emphasize public health as opposed to private profit.
You'd think that'd be a given.
But it's not.
Warren Olney, host of To The Point, the podcast. Download it wherever you get your podcasts, kcrw.com for one. Thank you so much. Okay. Coming up, it's Friday. That means it's time for movie reviews. We'll have those next for you on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. It's Friday. It means one thing, time to talk movies. The biggest movie of, well, ever is out today, Avengers Endgame. We'll talk about that. It's already broken records. It's had the largest Thursday opening ever. William Bibbiani is here. He is film critic and co-host of the podcast Canceled Too Soon and critically acclaimed. Welcome back.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Great to have you back. And Christine Lemire, also here, film critic for RogerEbert.com and co-host of the podcast Breakfast All Day. Hi.
Good to see you.
Good to see you. All right, let's begin. We're going to save the Avengers one for dessert, but let's begin with Body at Brighton Rock. It's a survival horror movie starring Karina Fontes.
You really need to leave. This is a crime scene.
Thought you said it was an accident.
Maybe not.
When did you say help was coming?
Soon.
Be careful up there. That area has active wildlife warning. Without an exact location, they're not going to get to you before dark.
Have a good night, Marshall.
Okay, William, the plot here. Survival on your own
in
the woods?
That clip, though, makes it sound like way more like hardcore intense than it really is. And even by design, this is actually a very unusual horror movie in a lot of ways. Karina Fontes plays a novice park ranger who is given a boring task of hiking around the trails, putting up safety notices, and then she gets lost and she doesn't know where she is. All she knows is she's stuck there with a dead body, and she doesn't know how that dead body got there, and she has to spend the whole night. There are dangerous animals out there. There might be some guy stalking her. She doesn't know, and a lot of this movie is just on Karina Fontes, and she's wonderful. Like, she's a really fun presence. She carries the movie very deftly, and I think one of the reasons why it works is because until that horror kicks in, it's a light comedy. Like, it's very eccentric in a very very affable way. You really like the characters and you like this world. And I love the transition the movie makes between I was just having a fun, wacky day and the horror begins. It's an unusual film, and I liked it a lot.
Roxanne Benjamin wrote and directed this, and I think because you have a woman at the helm here, a woman, you know, crafting and guiding the story, you have a really interesting female character at the center, and she is kind of unlike any horror heroine we have seen. She doesn't have to, you know, run through the woods half naked for titillating reasons. She thinks for herself, but she kind of figures it out along the way. As Bib said, she doesn't really know what she's doing. She's not a seasoned outdoors woman. And so she's kind of in the situation that any of us would be in, you know, when you're out in the middle of nowhere and you're trapped and you're scared. And I like the realism of it, but then there's also some weird kind of flights of not fantasy, but nightmare, you know, well, the thing she sees.
Her imagination is getting away with her a little bit, and you don't know what's real and what's not. There's a certain ghoulishness to the premise of just being trapped in the woods with a dead body. And as fun as the character is and as light as the movie can be, there's almost Edgar Allan Poe element to its construction, just that sort of morbidity to it. And I really, really love, this is Roxanne Benjamin's directorial feature debut. She's in a lot of anthology films until now, and this is a real step forward for her as a filmmaker.
And yet it's also very simple. I think the simplicity of it works.
I'm a big fan.
A woman, a dead body in the outdoors.
Yep, that's all you need.
And it works.
That's all you need.
If you're making a low-budget horror movie, this is a really great template.
All right, let us move on to J.T. Leroy, starring Kristen Stewart and Laura Dern.
So JT is like your pen name?
More like my avatar.
The book is doing really well.
People need to see JT now. When I first saw you, I thought you looked like him.
Huh?
Okay, so Christy, you saw this one. This is based on a true story, although truth and story, that's very fungible.
It's hazy.
Yeah.
As you know, there have been a couple of documentaries already made about this subject. But yeah, J.T. Leroy, quote unquote, was the celebrated author with this, you know, really rich, fascinating story behind, you know, his writing that he was a teen prostitute at truck stops and lived this horrible life, but he was a total fabrication of this woman, Laura Albert, who created this character as her nom de plume to write through. And this is the story of how Laura somehow got her sister-in-law, Savannah Canoop, played by Kristen Stewart, to go be the outward face of J.T. Leroy. And it worked for like 6 years.
She's kind of
androgynous
looking.
Right.
She puts on a wig and dark glasses, doesn't say much, kind of mumbles.
Yes. And so it's, the casting of Kristen Stewart is pretty perfect because she has played that kind of character before, but also has had that off-screen persona of being kind of androgynous and mysterious and hard to get to know. And so I wonder how much of it is her having a good time playing with her own, you know, perceived persona here. And it's sort of fascinating because it's a steadily building piece of suspense. Like, you just wonder, how long can this go on? How many people can they fool? They go to the Cannes Film Festival. I mean, there's eyes on them all the time. You think, how is everybody this stupid that they're being conned? But they got wrapped up in the idea of the romantic notion of quote-unquote JT's story.
Gosh,
and you are familiar with this story,
yeah,
too,
I am,
right?
And I've really followed it from the get-go, and all of us were conned. All of us believe that this author was this incredible young force. And the writing's really good, actually. I mean, when you read the writing, it's great. But then the story that goes beyond the writing has taken over the actual literary work and has become, obviously, its own story, its own movie, its own documentaries, et cetera, et cetera. And it's taken on a life of its own. I'm curious as to how Laura Albert is doing now in real life.
Oh, I don't know. I know, but the Savannah Canoop is part of this film. You know, she's a producer. I think
she had her own story, co-wrote then.
The script. So this is a lot of it is from her perspective, kind of trying to explain, look, here's what happened. Here's how I got sucked in. So you see a very sympathetic portrayal of Savannah because it's really her story. It's darkly funny here and there. It's kind of a farce. It's kind of silly. It's almost, you know, at Shakespearean levels of mistaken identity and gender fluidity and, you know, people pretending to be other people. And it's kind of silly until you realize, okay, people have really bought into this and they have been lied to and they are angry.
Right. So. And then it's one of those things where you couldn't make this stuff up.
It's crazy.
And yet it was made up partly.
It's a really good, the performances are all great. It's a really good cast. Everyone's really good at it. So it's entertaining.
Okay. J.T. Leroy. Finally, the big release this weekend, the highly anticipated Avengers Endgame.
We lost, all of us. We lost friends. We lost family. We lost a part of ourselves. This is the fight of our lives.
And William, some lives end.
Spoilers, but yeah, okay, sure. They've been very clear
well,
that there's...
you see that in the trailer, too.
That's true. They're very clear that this is a final chapter in this phase of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. And when you go into this movie already, there's so much buildup and anticipation just because it's hard to avoid these movies. I know some people have managed to, but most people have at least caught up on them very passively and just enjoyed them. And you realize now, wait a minute, we've been watching multiple chapters of this ongoing narrative.
How many?
We're nearly 24. It's about 22, I believe.
Okay.
And that's not including TV shows and the short films that they've made. And yeah, this is wrapping it all up. And I think, without giving anything away, I think they have found a really clever structure that allows them to look back on where they've been, to take every emotional beat totally seriously, but still find a way to tell an entertaining story full of delicious fan service that concludes the narrative. That's something these movies don't do. It's always about the next thing. The very first Marvel movie ended with, by the way, we're doing Avengers. This one, this is the
end
of something.
Are you sure?
Well, it's the end of, I think, Avengers movies. They're still going to make individual Marvel movies for the rest of our lives and beyond.
They might make more Avengers movies with different superheroes in it, but like this is very, this movie just says, this is the story. There will be another one, but it's not like just, and this one didn't count because the next one is coming out soon. They're very dedicated to this tale.
It's a tricky balancing act they pull off here because you're right. They do have to have a lot of fan service and they have to include all these characters they've introduced in all of these, not just Avengers movies, but all the individual, you know, character, Doctor Strange and Black Panther. Like they've got to get their arms around all of them and be funny and move well, but also have, you know, deeply resonant emotional beats because the fans really care. People were sobbing at my screening.
Sobbing.
Snuffling, sobbing.
In the good way.
Sobbing because of what's happened on screen or sobbing because it's the end?
Because they had to pee
series.
And it's 3 hours long. No, people are deeply emotionally invested in this. And there are, you know, there are sad things that happen. And then there are happy, sad things that happen. This is, I will say, the best work Chris Evans has ever done. And I've liked a lot of the eclectic choices he has made away from the Marvel world. He's really got to step up here as Captain America and be the heart in a lot of ways.
Yeah, everyone gets their moments. And yet, you know, there have been so many attempts within this franchise to combine the stories of all of these disparate characters. Some films worked better than others. Avengers worked fine. Age of Ultron and even Infinity War, to an extent, felt a little jumbled in a lot of ways. Here, they got all the pieces together in the previous film, and now they just get to tell this big, epic narrative. And as someone who grew up reading Marvel Comics, this isn't just an adaptation of a story. This feels like an actual approximation of a kind of story that comics can do really, really well and movies have always faltered about. This huge event narrative where you're following this very clear through line of one story that affects every single character in the universe, but also, if you read the Captain America comic as well, you get to see what Captain America is doing during all of that. You get to see what Iron Man is doing during all of that. And they all track. Everyone gets a complete arc. Every action thing pays off. Things from movies long past that you have long since forgot about come back in unexpected ways that are satisfying. They play fair. They're emotionally satisfying. They're funny.
You definitely have to have seen the other movies.
I was just going
to
ask you that. Let's say you were someone who didn't see any of those.
You'd be so, like, from the get-go, you'd be totally confused.
I think that's true for Infinity War as well, though. I think by this point, Marvel understands, hopefully we have you by now. Like, at this point, if this is your first movie, this is going to be a real deep dive, but we suspect you've probably seen most of it, and if you haven't, or if you haven't seen it in a while, I would recommend go to the Wikipedia page and just refresh yourself. If you haven't seen Thor the Dark World in a while or something, probably worth just brushing up on stuff like that, just so you remember it.
It is a comic.
It is.
It's not Shakespeare in the sense that in terms of complications, right?
It's actually incredibly complicated, actually. I would actually argue that the narrative in this is more intricate than pretty much any other superhero movie I can think of. I think they get away with it.
But I think in terms of, like, you know, philosophically, emotionally, ideologically, is it Shakespeare? I think it aims to be. I think it aims to matter like that and to be that culturally significant and to have those kinds of deeply resonant and traditional notions of good versus evil. Then they play with that.
And I think it's also worth remembering when we compare comic book movies to Shakespeare. Shakespeare was a populist author in his time. Mm-hmm. Those were blockbuster stories in their era. So really, this isn't that far off the mark. This is the story that is trying to just reach everybody, broach every topic, sell every character for high melodrama. I don't know if it's going to go down in history quite as well, but I don't think the comparison is altogether
might make a little
inept.
Bit more money. I don't know.
Well, adjust for inflation.
And it has a talking raccoon too, so don't discount that.
Raccoon. Such a good raccoon.
Shakespeare had one too.
In iambic pentameter.
Yes, exactly. All right. Christy Lemire, film critic and co-host of the podcast Breakfast All Day. William Bibbiani, film critic and co-host of the podcast Canceled Too Soon and critically acclaimed. Thank you both.
Thank you.
And that's it for us here on Press Play for today. We will be on at our new time beginning next Monday. So tune in at noon. It's 12 p.m., not 1 o'clock, as always. at 7 p.m. as well. And of course, we are a podcast. You can subscribe. Our producers are Sarah Sweeney, Michelle Aloy, Yael Evan Orr, Alex Trigvadottir, Caitlin Plummer, Rebecca Mooney, and Rosalie Atkinson. Amy Ta is our digital producer. Mario Saavedra is our technical director. I'm Madeline Brandt. Again, I will see you Monday at noon. Be there, or be square, or be a raccoon. I don't know. Have a great weekend.